On the morning of April 3rd, 2024, Taiwan was hit by a massive earthquake, the epicenter off the East Coast. As media reports came in, a common theme was heard, that this was the worst earthquake since the 921 quake. Those of us who were here 25 years ago for that huge quake, which became known as 921, for September the 21st, likely remember the quake well. It was horrific. And while the quake on April 3rd will take a sad toll in damage and, more importantly, lives, it thankfully, despite being very close in power, will not exact the pain that the 921 quake did. Firstly, the epicenters were very different. The 921 quake, which hit in 1999, was in the center of the island, underground, while the April 3rd quake struck off the coast of Hualien. And secondly, Taiwan did learn a lot from 921. And while a few problems persist, today this earthquake-prone island is an exceptionally safer place than it was in 1999. I was here in central Taiwan when the 921 earthquake struck. And in fact, that very morning I was planning to start a long hike along the length of Taiwan. I wrote about it in a book called Formosan Odyssey, and my Formosa Files co-host Eric Michael Smith is going to read a slightly edited version of the first chapter of Formosan Odyssey, a chapter simply called The 921 Earthquake.
As summer and months of preparation drew to a close, I spread my relief maps of Taiwan out across the floor one last time. The contour lines of the central ranges were so closely packed they merged into a single dark foreboding mass running the length of my room. This shadow marked the route of my intended journey from the northernmost point in Taiwan, along the mountainous spine, to the southernmost point. I would travel entirely on foot, a 2-month solo trek that my Taiwanese friends said was impossible. Taiwan has some surprisingly majestic landscapes. Over half of the country is made up of rugged mountain ranges, with more than 200 peaks rising above 3,000 meters. Mount Jade, Yushan, at 3,952 meters, is the highest mountain in East Asia. After years of living in a small town in the crowded lowlands, I was eager to get away from the horrible traffic, pollution, and heat, to escape the landscape of factories and concrete box architecture, and travel alone through the parallel world of the high mountains, so close yet so often hidden behind smog. I had one last drinking session with my good friend Khan and went to bed contemplating my trip. At 1:47 a.m., on the 21st of September, 1999, central Taiwan was hit by a massive earthquake measuring 7.3 on the Richter scale. By the time the last bodies were dragged from the rubble, the death toll would be well over 2,000. But when it struck, I, like many others, didn't realize the magnitude of the disaster. Woken by the rocking motion and the clang of metal windows, my initial reaction was just annoyance. Bloody earthquake, I thought, rolled over, and tried to get back to sleep. Earthquakes are common in Taiwan, and I figured the shaking would pass. The summer before, I'd experienced what seemed like a worse one. At that time, I'd been awake and sober on the 7th floor of a building, with things crashing down around me, and had feared for my life. This time the shaking was violent enough, but nothing was falling off desks and bookshelves, and I was only on the 3rd floor of a 4-story building. My room was in a private cram school, and I shared the building with Miss Sue, an eccentric old cleaning lady, and Con, an English teacher from Ireland. I could hear excited voices gathering in the street outside, Miss Sue bellowing, and Con walking up the stairs. "You all right, John?" "Yeah. Earthquake. All I need." The aftershocks kept hitting, shaking me fully awake, and I had to give up trying to sleep through it. I usually have a hellish time getting back to sleep, so I decided to go get some beer, drink for a while, and then hit the sack. I got dressed and went outside. All the neighbors were out on the street, some in bedclothes. I walked past them zombie-like to a nearby 7-Eleven. The 24-hour convenience store, amazingly still open, stank of whiskey, and the floor was strewn with broken glass and pools of liquid. The shell-shocked young clerk who served me was certainly earning his money that night. Aftershocks were announced a second before they hit by an ominous metallic roar. They kept rolling in one after another, sometimes so strongly that they had the ground waving for several seconds. The realization was starting to dawn on us that this was something out of the ordinary. And as details came through on the radio, reports of mass destruction, bridges and roads torn up, high-rise apartments collapsing, our worst fears were realized. Taiwan was suffering a terrible disaster. Standing out on the street with my neighbors, as most Taiwanese were doing at that moment, there was a strange mixture of feelings, both individual and collective, of fear, shock, sorrow, and thankfulness at being safe. And increasingly, weariness, for there would be no sleep for the next 2 days. The ground had seemingly turned to liquid, and aftershocks were only minutes apart. One saving grace was that the epicenter was beneath Jiji, a small town 12.5 kilometers west of Sun Moon Lake in Nantou County, central Taiwan. If it had hit a major city like Taipei or Kaohsiung, instead of the relatively sparsely populated rural area around Jiji, the damage would have been catastrophic. Even though the quake's strength in Taipei was only 4 on the Richter scale, some buildings there still came down, including the 12-story Songshan Hotel, which collapsed on itself, floor after floor driven into the basement, leaving less than half the building above ground. The 921 earthquake, as it became known, was the island's strongest of the century, and one of the world's biggest of the 1990s. It left over 2,400 dead, over 11,000 injured, and more than 100,000 homeless. Considering Taiwan's history of quakes, the authorities were not particularly well prepared, but the immediate response was quick. The rescue teams, soldiers, medical teams, and volunteers who rushed into the area worked around the clock looking for trapped survivors and pulling out dead bodies in the face of great danger from the endless aftershocks. There were literally hundreds of aftershocks every day, some of them over 6 on the Richter scale. Meanwhile, the country watched the drama on television. The disaster brought a sense of warmth and unity to communities across the nation. Almost everyone had been woken by it, could imagine the worst, were thankful to be alive, and many people knew someone affected. People pulled together. There was no chaos, no looting, little panic, and throughout, the island's neighbors and strangers alike were out on the streets talking to each other in a way they had never done before. Even during Taiwan's darkest hour, China could not refrain from playing politics. As news of the earthquake broke, condolences and offers of assistance poured in from world leaders, among them U.S. President Clinton. Foreign rescue teams were dispatched, but there were several notable exceptions. The United Nations could not send any immediate assistance because it considers Taiwan a province of China and needed the Beijing government to request help on behalf of Taiwan. The United Nations eventually sent an embarrassingly small 6-man team. That was in stark contrast to Taiwan's generous donation of $300 million to the organization, made just months previously, for humanitarian work in Kosovo. Chinese President Jiang Zemin sent condolences and offers of assistance. This opportunity for a thawing of relations was spoiled by political bigotry. The statements of sympathy were soured by nationalist slogans, reasserting the fiction of Taiwan being part of China, and constant references to bonds between the two. Reminders that, quote, blood is thicker than water, end quote, and that the people across the Taiwan Straits were, quote, as closely linked as flesh and blood, end quote. China state television fabricated news reports to suggest that Chinese rescue workers and supplies were on their way. For the communist leaders, the quake was a good opportunity to push their One China policy, the idea that Taiwan is an inseparable part of Chinese territory rather than a sovereign nation. But in trying to make political capital of the disaster, they went too far. In the words of an old proverb that was much on people's lips, China was stealing from a house on fire. In a statement that caused great offense, the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan sent his sympathies to the people of the Taiwan province of China, a province. Even worse, the Chinese foreign minister, speaking at the United Nations as if he could speak on behalf of the Taiwanese, thanked the international community for its assistance. Although a little disorganized and uncoordinated, Taiwan's rescue and relief effort generally earned high praise, making up for a lack of professionalism with human effort. The public joined in with a flood of donated money, supplies, and helping hands. So many blood donors came forward, there weren't enough places to store blood. And amid the tragic stream of news stories, there were heartwarming scenes of rescues, such as when a 6-year-old boy was pulled from a wrecked apartment building, where he and his family have been buried for 88 hours. Once located, Korean and Japanese rescue workers had toiled for 6 hours to reach the boy. For a country that is so often politically isolated and has few diplomatic friends, the international help, over 750 foreigners from 21 countries, from as far afield as Mexico, Austria, Spain, Israel, and the Czech Republic, made a deep impression on the Taiwanese, and made China look all the worse. While the earthquakes in Turkey and Greece in 1999 allowed an improvement in relations between those two ancient foes, the 921 quake widened the rift, leaving people in Taiwan angry, hurt, and ever more distrustful. It strengthened the Taiwanese sense of identity and unity, and highlighted the chasm between democratic island and authoritarian state. China was not the only villain of the drama. As the pattern of damage emerged and the crews worked their way through buildings, it became obvious that countless lives had been lost because of shoddy construction. In the small city of Douliu, just 8 kilometers from where I lived, 3 new apartment buildings, all built by the same company, had collapsed. In the debris, cooking oil cans were found in the structural supports. Elsewhere, similar cost-saving shortcuts in construction, such as watered-down cement and substandard materials, were uncovered. One of the most shocking things about the damage was the proportionally high rate of damage suffered by public buildings. They are, in theory anyway, subject to a stricter building code than private buildings, and so should have been the last to collapse. Much the reverse. 120 schools were destroyed or severely damaged in the earthquake, and another 700 suffered slight damage. The engineer's verdict was that the blame lay with basic flaws in the standard school design and the unsupervised contract system, which led to cost-cutting, corruption, and shoddy work. A lot of parents and teachers were wondering what would have happened if the earthquake had struck during school hours. Modern buildings, especially high ones, are supposed to be built to strict Japanese standards, but the regulations are not strictly followed or policed, so once again, the pattern of damage one would have expected, old buildings collapsing, whereas newer, safer ones stood, didn't occur. The ruins and buried corpses were a ghastly monument to the ugly side of Taiwanese society: corruption, greed, and carelessness, best expressed in a common expression, 差不多, meaning close enough. But in the mood emerging after the initial shock and anger, there was optimism for the future. People reevaluating life's priorities and expressing hopes of rebuilding a better society from the rubble. Materialism and consumerism had gone wild. What had seemed important before the quake, such as collecting Hello Kitty dolls, a Japanese cartoon character, and having the latest model cell phone, now seemed trivial, almost grotesque. My hiking trip, of course, was over before it had begun. The central ranges had been ripped apart, whole mountains disappearing, rivers blocked and lakes formed. In an instant, my maps had become historical documents. Rockfalls and landslides had obliterated trails. Bridges were destroyed and roads made impassable. The greater part of my intended route lay in an emergency zone, unreachable by land and officially closed. Seismologists had been warning that Taiwan was overdue for a big earthquake for years because of a buildup of pressure along the tectonic plates that converge under the island, but had been unable, however, to give any specific warning of the 921 quake. The bad news was that they were unsure whether it was in fact the big one and weren't ruling out another massive jolt. Rumors of impending disaster, quakes stronger than the first, spread around the city by word of mouth, radio phone-ins, and internet bulletin boards. Sometimes the rumors gave exact places, dates, and times. The source of many of these rumors and apocalyptic predictions were temples, and there was a story circulating, which many people believed, that a temple had actually warned of the earthquake. The omen supposedly took place at the Taoist Tai Chi Kong Temple in Taoyuan on the night of June 23rd. The temple worshippers were using divining blocks, small wooden boards shaped like crescent moons. After asking a question, these boards are dropped on the floor 3 times, the answer determined by whether they land with the flat or rounded side up. But that night in Taoyuan, the laws of physics took a time out. The boards stood on end, balancing on their tips, and remained like that for 2 months until 2 young girls picked them up. The surprised worshippers consulted the heavens. The answer, channeled through one of the worshippers, was the usual vague stuff of prophecies: stop sinning or face destruction. God gave another more specific message in April,
You do not fulfill your obligations to lead a virtuous life. This is not allowed. This earthquake is just a small sample of the bad luck to come. You must listen to me. Because of God's will, Formosa will suffer many disasters this year. The story was obviously the work of opportunists, trying to get a little publicity for the temple, and with it, money. But many Taiwanese people are very superstitious, and many believed it. Considering the thousands of fortune tellers there are throughout Taiwan, their pre-quake silence was rather poor. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, people started uncovering all sorts of strange omens that had passed unnoticed. From the story of a giant white fish, a warning of disaster, said to have been caught off the southwestern coast just days before the quake, to the story of a winning lottery ticket with the numbers 9444-5421. In Chinese, the numbers sound like 9, death, 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 definitely death, 2-1. Temples rushed to make predictions of further calamity. It was a low-risk gamble. If the predictions didn't come true, no one would bother or remember. But if something happened, then it would mean an immense boost to the temple's reputation. And with that, donations. Police brought charges against the Taoyuan Temple for inciting public disorder when it started handing out thousands of flyers, warning people that another huge quake would hit on October 4th. A week after the earthquake, I packed my bags and headed north to begin my trip through Taiwan. The quake had forced me to abandon my plan to walk from here to Kending in the extreme south of Taiwan, but I still pressed on with a modified version of my Formosan Odyssey.
The Taiwan History Podcast, Formosa Files, is made possible through the generous sponsorship of the Frank C. Chen Foundation. Formosa Files.